The redwoods knock all words out of them. Nick drives in silence. Even the young trunks are like angels. And when, after a few miles, they pass a monster, sprouting a first upward-swooping branch 40 feet in the air, as thick as most eastern trees, he knows. The word tree must grow up, get real. It's not the size that throws him, or not just the size. It's the grooved Doric perfection of the red-brown columns, shooting upward from the shoulder-high ferns and moss-swarmed floor, straight up, with no taper, like a russet, leathery apotheosis. And when the columns do start to crown, it happens so high, so removed from the pillar's base, that it might as well be a second world up there, up nearer eternity. All the agitation of the journey ebbs from Olivia. It's like she knows the place, although she has never been west of Six Flags over Mid-America. Along a narrow road, through the coastal forest, she calls out, "Stop the car!" He pulls over onto a shoulder soft with needles a few feet deep. The car door opens, and the air tastes sweet and savory. She wanders out from the passenger side into a grove of giants. When he joins her, her face is streaked and her eyes hot and liquid with joy. She shakes her head, incredulous. "This is it. This is them. We're here." The defenders of the forest aren't hard to find. Different groups are organizing throughout the Lost Coast. There's a report of some action almost every day in the local papers. Nick and Olivia live rough, car camping for a few days, feeling out who's who in a ragtag cast that is makeshift and an organization that is improvised, to say the least. They learn about a volunteer encampment in the muddy fields of a sympathetic retired fisherman not far from Solace. The bivouac swarms with more activity than coherence. Quick young people, loud in their devotion, call across the tent-dotted meadow. Their noses, ears, and eyebrows flash with hardware. Dreadlocks tangle in the fibers of their multicolored garb. They stink of soil, sweat, idealism, patchouli oil, and the sweet sinsamilla grown all through these woods. Some stay for 2 days. Some, judging from their microflora, have been in this base camp for more than a few seasons. The camp is one of many nerve centers for a chaotic movement without leaders that mostly goes under the name of Life Defense Force. Nick and Olivia scout the fields, talking to everyone. They share a dinner of eggs and beans with an older man named Moses. He, for his part, questions and vets them, too, assuring himself that they aren't spies for Weyerhaeuser or Boise Cascade, or the more proximal force in these parts, Humboldt Timber. "How do we get assignments?" Nick asks. The word makes Moses laugh out loud.
"No assignments here, but no end of work."
They cook for dozens and help clean up afterward. There's a march the next day. Nick letters posters while Olivia joins the sing-along. A flame-haired, plaid-clad, hawk-silhouetted woman passes through camp wrapped in a woven shawl. Olivia grabs Nick.
"It's her, the one from the television clip back in Indiana.
The one the beings of light wanted her to find." Moses nods.
"That's Mother N. She can turn a megaphone into a strad."
As the light falls, Mother N holds an orientation talk in a clearing next to Moses's tent. She scans the rings of seated bodies, acknowledging veterans and welcoming newcomers.
"It's good to see so many of you still here this late in the season. In the past, a lot of you have headed home for the winter, when the rains shut down the logging shows until spring. But Humboldt Timber has started working year-round."
Boos ripple through the crowd.
They're trying to get the cut out before the law catches up with them. But they haven't counted on all of you.
A cheer breaks like a whitecap over Nicholas. He turns to Olivia and takes her hand. She squeezes back, as if this isn't the first time he has touched her in gladness. She beams, and Nick marvels again at her certainty. She has gotten them this far, navigating by feel.
"Warmer. This way. Warmer."
Whispered instructions from presences only she can hear. And here they are, like they knew where they were going all along.
"A lot of you have been out here for a while," Mother N continues. "So much useful work. Picketing, guerrilla theater, peaceful demonstrations."
Moses rubs his shaved head and shouts, "Now we put the fear of God in them."
The cheer redoubles. Even Mother N smiles.
"Well, maybe. But the LDF takes nonviolence seriously. For those of you who just arrived, we want you to take passive resistance training and pledge the nonviolence code before joining any direct action. We do not condone outright property destruction."
Moses shouts, "But you'd be surprised at what a little quick-drying cement around a wheelbase can do."
The edges of Mother N's lips twist.
"We're part of a very long, very broad process all over the world. If those beautiful Chipko women in India can let themselves get threatened and beaten, if Brazilian Kayapo Indians can put their lives on the line, so can we."
It's drizzling. Nick and Olivia hardly notice.
"Most of you already know all about Humboldt Timber. For those who don't, they were a family business for almost a century. They ran the last progressive company town in the state and paid incredible benefits. Their pension system was overfunded. They took care of their own and rarely hired gypos. Best of all, they cut selectively, for a yield they might have sustained forever. Because they cut the old stuff slowly, they still had several billion board feet of the best softwood on the planet, long after their competitors all along the coast shot their bolts. 200,000 acres. 40% of the area's remaining old growth. But HT's stock price lagged compared to those companies out there maximizing profits, which, by the rules of capitalism, meant somebody had to come in and show the old-timers how to run a business. You remember Henry Hansen, the junk bond king? The guy who went to jail last year for racketeering? He set up the deal. A raider buddy of his pulled off the steal, all the way from Wall Street. Ingenious, really. You pour junk-raised cash into a hostile takeover and sell the debt to your savings and loan, which the public ultimately must bail out. Then you mortgage the company to the hilt to pay off the funny money, loot the pension fund, run through the reserves, sell off everything of value, and dispose of the remaining bankrupt husk for whatever you can get. Magic! Loot that pays you extra to plunder it. Right now, they're in that second to the last stage, cashing out every saleable scrap of timber in the inventory, which in this case means lots of 700- and 800-year-old trees. Trees wider than your dreams are going into Mill B and coming out as planks. Humboldt is cutting at 4 times the industry rate, and they're speeding up before legislation can catch up with them.
Nick turns to Olivia. The girl is years younger than he is, but he has begun to look to her for explanations. Her face stiffens, and her eyes close in pain. Tears roll down her cheekbones.
"Obviously, We can't wait for legislation. The new, efficient Humboldt timber will have killed all the giants by the time the law catches up with them. So this is the question I ask each of you. What can you bring to the effort? We'll take anything you can give. Time, effort, cash. Cash is surprisingly helpful.
Applause and cheers ring out after her talk, and people retreat to a meal of lentil soup made over several campfires. Olivia helps cook. She who used to steal her housemate's food from the fridge rather than boil a little water for ramen. Nick senses these forest men, some who haven't bathed in weeks, striving for blasé as she serves them, as if a dryad hadn't just dropped down into this meadow next to them. A band, under the supervision of a man named Blackbeard, returns from a raid, gumming up a parked Caterpillar D8 engine with corn syrup. They glow with accomplishment in the campfire's flicker. They mean to go out again after dark to test the company's vigil on larger gear farther up the hillside.
I don't like property crimes, Mother N says. I really don't.
Moses laughs her off.
No valuable property has been destroyed except these forests. We're in a war of attrition. We tie the lumber crews up for a few hours. Then they repair the machines. But in the meantime, they lose time and dollars.
Blackbeard glowers at the flames.
Humboldt is nothing but property crimes, and we're supposed to make nice?
24 volunteers start talking over one another. After years in rural Iowa, Nick's like a kid raised on a tinny radio hearing his first live symphony. He has landed in a druid tree cult, like the ones he read about on winter nights in the Whole Family Encyclopedia. Oak veneration at the Oracle at Dodona, the druids' groves in Britain and Gaul, Shinto Sakaki worship, India's bejeweled wishing tree, Mayan kapox, Egyptian sycamores, the Chinese sacred ginkgo, all the branches of the world's first religion. His decade of obsessive sketching has been practice for whatever art this sect requires of him. Olivia leans in.
Are you okay?
His reply sticks in his wide, coprophagic grin. The raid party readies to head out again. Blackbeard, Needles, Moss Eater, and the Revelator. Warriors competing for the palm, the laurel, the olive.
Hang on, Nick tells them. Let's try something.
He sits them on a camping stool in the shadows of the fire while he paints their faces. He dips a brush into a can of green latex that a woman named Tinkerbell uses to letter banners. He follows the contours of their skulls, the curves of their foreheads, and the mounds of cheekbone, finding his way forward into whirls and spirals, surreal freehand memories of Maori tamoko tattoos, tie-dyed tees and paisley faces. The effect is devastating. The Knights Commandos stand back and admire each other. Something enters them. They become other beings, inscribed and altered, filled with power by ancient signs.
Jesus H! This'll scare the shit out of them!
Moses shakes his head at the new guy's handiwork.
It's good. We want them to think we're dangerous.
Olivia comes up behind Nick in pride. She curls her hands beneath his upper arm. She has no clue what that does to him, after days together on the cross-country car ride, nights side by side in thick sleeping bags. Or maybe she knows and doesn't care.
Nice work, she whispers.
He shrugs. Not especially useful.
Urgent. I have it on good authority.
They christen themselves with forest names that night, in the soft drizzle of the redwoods, on a blanket of needles. The game seems childish at first, but all of art is childish, all storytelling, all human hope and fear. Why shouldn't they take new names for this new work? Trees go by a dozen different labels. There's Texas and Spanish and false Buckeye and Manillo, all for the same plant. Trees with names as profligate as maple seeds. There's Buttonwood, a.k.a. Plane Tree, a.k.a. Sycamore. Like a man with a drawer full of fake passports. In one place, there's Lime, in another, Linden. Tilia at large, but Basswood when turned into lumber or honey. 28 names for longleaf pine alone. Olivia appraises Nick in the darkness, far from the fire. She squints for evidence of what to call him. Pushes his hair back behind his ears, tilts his chin in her cool hands.
Watchman. Does that sound right? You're my watchman.
Observer, bystander, would-be protector. He grins, discovered.
Name me now.
He reaches out and takes a fingerful of that wheaty stuff that soon will never be lighter than mud. It fans out under his fingers. Maidenhair.
That's a real thing?
It is, he tells her, another name for a living fossil. Earlier than flowering trees, early as the earliest conifers, a native for a while in these headwaters, then disappeared for millions of years before returning in cultivation. A tree from back at the beginning of trees. She curls against him in the pup tent as they fall asleep, made safe from anything more intimate than warmth by the proximity of so many other volunteers. He lies gazing at her back, the slight rise and fall of her ribcage. The t-shirt she uses for pajamas slips off her shoulder, revealing a tattoo across her scapula in florid script. A change is gonna come. He lies as still as he can, a tumescent monk. He counts the poundings of his heart high up in his ears until the surf weakens into sleep. As he drifts off, a spidery thought spins through him. People from another planet will wonder what's wrong with earthly names, that it takes so many different ones to tag a thing. But here he lies, alongside this friend he has known only weeks, joined again after so many lifetimes. Nick and Olivia, Watchman and Maidenhair, the complete quartet of them, open to the January night, under topless columns of coastal redwood, the ever-living Semper Virens. Patricia Westerford sits on her ladder-backed chair at the pine farmhouse table, pen in the air, taking dictation from the insects. 11 o'clock nears, and she has nothing. Not one sentence she hasn't revised to death. The wind wafts through the window, smelling of compost and cedar. The scent triggers an old, deep longing that seems to have no purpose. The woods are calling, and she must go. All winter she has struggled to describe the joy of her life's work and the discoveries that have solidified in a few short years. How trees talk to one another. Over the air and underground, how they care and feed each other, orchestrating shared behaviors through the networked soil, how they build immune systems as wide as a forest. She spends a chapter detailing how a dead log gives life to countless other species. Remove the snag and kill the woodpecker who keeps in check the weevils that would kill the other trees. She describes the droops, and racemes, panicles, and involucres that a person could walk past for a lifetime and never notice. She tells how the woody-coned alders harvest gold, how an inch-high pecan might have 6 feet of root, how the inner bark of birches can feed the starving, how one hop hornbeam catkin holds several million grains of pollen, how indigenous fishermen used to crush walnut leaves to stun and catch fish, how willows clean soils of dioxins, PCBs, and heavy metals. She lays out how fungal hyphae, countless miles of filaments folded up in every spoon of soil, coax open tree roots and tap into them. How the wired-up fungi feed the tree minerals. How the tree pays for these nutrients with sugars, which the fungi can't make. Something marvelous is happening underground, something we're just learning how to see. Mats of mycorrhizal cabling link trees into gigantic, smart communities spread across hundreds of acres. Together, they form vast trading networks of goods, services, and information. There are no individuals in a forest, no separable events. The bird and the branch it sits on are a joint thing. A third or more of the food a big tree makes may go to feed other organisms. Even different kinds of trees form partnerships. Cut down a birch and a nearby Douglas fir may suffer. In the great forests of the East, oaks and hickories synchronize their nut production to baffle the animals that feed on them. Word goes out, and the trees of a given species, whether they stand in sun or shade, wet or dry, bear heavily or not at all, together, as a community. Forests mend and shape themselves through subterranean synapses. And in shaping themselves, they shape, too, the tens of thousands of other linked creatures that form it from within. Maybe it's useful to think of forests as enormous, spreading, branching, underground super trees. She tells how an elm helped start the American Revolution, how a huge 500-year-old mesquite grows in the middle of one of the planet's most arid deserts, how the glimpse of a horse chestnut through a window gave Anne Frank hope, even in hopeless hiding. How seeds brought to the moon and back sprouted all over the earth. How the world is inhabited by magnificent creatures no one knows. How it may take centuries to learn as much about trees as people once knew. Her husband lives 14 miles away in town. They see each other once a day for lunches that Dennis makes from whatever is in season. All day and all night long, her only people are the trees, and her only means of speaking for them are words, those organs of saprophytic latecomers that live off the energy green things make. Journal articles have always been hard enough. Her years as an outcast come back to her each time she writes one, even when she's only one of a dozen co-authors. She feels even more anxiety when others are on board. She'd sooner retire again than inflict on these beloved colleagues anything like what she once suffered. Yet even journal articles are a walk in the woods compared to writing for the public. Scientific papers sit in archives, matters of indifference to almost everyone. But this millstone book, she's sure to be mocked and misunderstood in the press, and she'll never earn out what her publisher has already paid. All winter long, she has struggled with how to tell a stranger everything she knows. The months have been hell, but paradise, too. Soon enough, the hellish paradise will end. In August, she'll close her field lab, pack up the gear, and remove all her meticulous samples to the coast and that university where she'll, unthinkable, begin to teach again. The words refuse to come tonight. She should simply sleep and see what her dreams might say. Instead, she cranes to glimpse the kitchen clock above the antique slope-shouldered refrigerator. Still time for a midnight wander down to the pond. The spruces near the cabin wave spooky prophecies under the near-full moon. There's a straight line of them, the memory of a vanished fence where red crossbills once liked to sit and shit out seeds. The trees are busy tonight, fixing carbon in their dark phase. All will be in flower before long. Huckleberry and currant, showy milkweed, tall Oregon grape, yarrow, and checkermallow. She marvels again at how the planet's supreme intelligence could discover calculus and the universal laws of gravitation before anyone knew what a flower was for. Tonight, the stands are as drizzled and murky as her word-filled mind. She finds the trail and ducks beneath her beloved Sudotsuga. A path cuts under the spires lit by late winter's moon, a path she walks almost nightly, out and back, like that old palindrome, La ruta nos aportó otro paso natural. The many uncatalogued volatile compounds breathed out by needles at night slow her heart rate, soften her breathing, and if she's right, even alter her mood and thoughts. So many substances in woodland pharmacies that no one has yet identified. Powerful molecules in bark, pith, and leaves, whose effects have yet to be discovered. One family of distress hormones used by her trees, jasminate, supplies the punch to all those feminine perfumes that play on mystery and intrigue. Sniff me, love me, I'm in trouble. And they are in trouble, all these trees, all the forests of the world, even the quaintly named set-aside lands. More trouble than she has the heart to tell readers of her little book. Trouble, like the atmosphere, flows everywhere, in currents beyond the power of humans to predict or control. She pops out into the pond's clearing. The starry sky erupts above her, all the explanation a person needs for why humans have waged war on forests forever. Dennis has told her what the loggers say.
Let's go let a little light into that swamp.
Forests panic people. Too much going on there. Humans need a sky. Her seat is vacant and waiting, that moss-blanketed nurse log by the water's edge. The moment she looks out over the water, her head clears, and she finds the passage she's after. She has searched for a name for the great ancient trunks of the uncut forest, the ones who keep the market in carbons and metabolites going. Now she has one. Fungi mine stone to supply their trees with minerals. They hunt springtails, which they feed to their hosts. Trees, for their part, store extra sugar in their fungi's synapses to dole out to the sick and shaded and wounded. A forest takes care of itself, even as it builds the local climate it needs to survive. Before it dies, a Douglas fir, half a millennium old, will send its storehouse of chemicals back down into its roots and out through its fungal partners, donating its riches to the community pool in a last will and testament. We might well call these ancient benefactors giving trees. The reading public needs such a phrase to make the miracle a little more vivid, visible. It's something she learned long ago from her father. People see better what looks like them. Giving trees is something any generous person can understand and love. And with those two words, Patricia Westerford seals her own fate and changes the future. Even the future of trees. In the morning, she splashes cold water on her face, makes a flaxberry slurry, drinks it while reading yesterday's pages, then sits at the pine table, vowing not to stand up until she has a paragraph worthy of showing Dennis at lunch. The smell of her red cedar pencil elates her. The slow push of graphite across paper reminds her of the steady evaporation that lifts hundreds of gallons of water up hundreds of feet into a giant Douglas fir trunk every day. The solitary act of sitting over the page and waiting for her hand to move may be as close as she'll ever get to the enlightenment of plants. The final chapter eludes her. She needs some impossible trifecta, hopeful, useful, and true. She could use old Chico, that Norway spruce who lives about midway up the length of Sweden. Above the ground, the tree is only a few hundred years old, but below, in the microbe-riddled soil, he reaches back 9,000 years or more, thousands of years older than this trick of writing she uses to try to capture it. All morning long, she works to squeeze the 9,000-year saga into 10 sentences. A procession of trunks falling and springing back up from the same root. There's the hopeful she's after. The truth is somewhat more brutal. By late morning, she catches up to the present, when, for the first time, the new man-made atmosphere coaxes the latest of old Chico's usually snow-stunted Krumholtz trunks to shoot up into a full-sized tree. But hope and truth do nothing for humans without use. In the clumpy, clumsy finger-paint of words, she searches for the use of old Chico, up on that barren crest, endlessly dying and resurrecting in every change of climate. His use is to show that the world is not made for our utility. What use are we to trees? She remembers the Buddha's words, "A tree is a wondrous thing that shelters, feeds, and protects all living things. It even offers shade to the axemen who destroy it." And with those words, she has her book's end. Dennis shows at noon, reliable as rain, bearing broccoli almond lasagna, his latest midday masterpiece. She thinks, as she does several times a week, how lucky she has been to spend these few blessed years married to the one man on earth who'd let her spend most of her life alone. Game, patient, good-natured Dennis. He protects her work and needs so little. In his handyman's heart, he already knows how few things man is really the measure of, and he's as generous and eager as weeds. As they eat Dennis's feast, she reads him today's installment on Old Chico. He listens, astonished, like a happy child might listen to Greek myths. She finishes. He claps.
"Oh, babe, it's just fine."
Something deep in her callow green soul likes being the world's oldest babe.
"I hate to tell you this, but I think you're done."
It's terrifying, but he's right. She sighs and stares out the kitchen window, where three crows hatch their elaborate plans for breaking into her compost bin. "So, what do I do now?" His laugh is as hearty as if she said something funny.
"You type it up, and we mail it to your publishers, 4 months late."
"I can't."
"Why not?"
"Everything's wrong, starting with the title."
"What's wrong with How Trees Will Save the World? Trees won't save the world?"
"I'm sure they will, after the world shrugs us off." He chuckles and packs up the dirty dishes. He'll take them home, where there are deep sinks, strainers, and hot water. He looks across the kitchen at her.
"Call it Forest Salvation. Then you don't have to commit to who's saving what."
"I do love you."
"Did someone say you didn't? Look, babe, this should be pure pleasure, talking to people about your life's great joy."
"You know, Den, the last time I was in the public eye, it didn't go so well."
He swipes at the air. "That was another lifetime.
Wolfpack. They didn't want to disprove me. They wanted blood."
"But you've been exonerated, over and over."
She wants to tell him what she has never mentioned, how the trauma of those days was so great that she cooked herself a fatal woodland's feast. But she can't. She's too ashamed of that long-dead girl. Part of her no longer entirely believes that she could ever have considered such a course. Deniable theater. A game. So she conceals the only thing she has ever kept from him. How she had the poison mushrooms all but in her mouth.
Babe, you're practically a prophetess these days.
I also spent a lot of years as a pariah. Prophetess is much more fun. She helps him out to the car with the dirty dishes. Love you, then.
Please stop saying that. You're spooking me.
She types up the draft. She prunes a few words and pollards a few phrases. There's now a chapter called The Giving Trees, about her beloved Doug Firs and their underground welfare state. She ranges around the country's forests, from cottonwoods that top 100 feet in a decade to bristlecone pines that die slowly for 5,000 years. Then the post office, where all her anxiety drains out of her the minute she pays the postage and sends the manuscript off to the other coast. 6 weeks later, her office phone rings. She hates the phone. Handheld schizophrenia. Unseen voices whispering to you from a distance. Nobody calls her except with unpleasant business. It's her editor, whom she has never met, from New York, a city she has never seen.
Patricia? Your book! I just finished it!
Patricia winces, waiting for the axe.
Unbelievable! Who knew that trees got up to all those things?
Well, a few 100 million years of evolution gives you a repertoire.
You make them come alive.
Actually, they were alive already. But she's thinking of the book her father gave her when she was 14. She realizes she must dedicate this book to her father and to her husband and all the people who will, in time, turn into other things.
Patty, you wouldn't believe what you have me seeing between the subway stop and my office. That part about the giving trees? Mind-blowing! We didn't pay you enough for this.
You paid me more than I've made in the last 5 years.
You'll earn out in 2 months.
What Patricia Westerford would like to earn back is her solitude, her anonymity, which she begins to sense, the way trees can sense an invasion still far away, will never be hers again. Mastery arrives, and there's no turning back. 2 months after the game's North American release, the president, CEO, and majority stockholder of Semper Virens fires up a copy on his workhorse machine in his apartment on the floor above the company's shiny new headquarters in the foothills up Page Mill Road. It's all redwood and glass, a playground of whimsical, meditative spaces. Odd angles surround open-air atriums planted with giant Italian stone pines. Working at your carrel feels like camping out in a national park. Nile's refuge is tucked away on high, above the hive. The only way to reach it is by private elevator, hidden behind a fire stairwell. At the center of the concealed den sits a complex hospital bed. Nile almost never uses it anymore. 40 minutes to get in and out of. It feels like death these days, even to lie down. There's no time. He sleeps in his chair, rarely more than 40 minutes at a shot. Ideas torture him like the Furies. Plans and breakthroughs for his world in progress chase him around the galaxy without mercy. He sits in front of a giant screen at a work surface high enough for him to slip the chair under. Past the screen, a plate glass panorama reveals the top of Monte Bello. That view and the starscapes shining through the night skylight make up most of Nile's voyages abroad. His forays now are like today's. Expeditions down the coasts of landmasses that start out shrouded in fog and open into discovery. He designed the game's foundations, wrote a fair portion of the code, and spent months working through its possible paths. Mastery should have had no more power to surprise him, yet it never fails to quicken his pulse. A click of the mouse, a few keystrokes, and he's face to face again with the next virgin continent. In truth, the game is pathetic. It's two-dimensional. No smell, no touch, no taste, no feel. It's tiny and grainy, with a world model as simplistic as Genesis. Yet it sinks its teeth into his brainstem whenever he fires it up. The maps, climates, and scattered resources are new each time in. His opponents may be conquistadors, builders, or technocrats, nature worshippers, misers, humanitarians, or radical utopians. Nothing quite like this place has ever existed. Yet going there feels like coming home. His mind has been waiting for such a playground since long before he fell from his betraying tree. Today he chooses to be a sage. Rumor is spreading across dial-up bulletin boards from around the globe about an overpowered victory strategy players are calling enlightenment. Top-ranked leaders are pushing for the whole approach to be banned. But even as a sage, he must acquire sufficient coal, gold, ore, stone, wood, food, honor, and glory to pay for his population growth. He must explore unknown terrain, form trade routes, and raid neighboring settlements, working his way along branching trees for culture, craft, economics, and technology. The game presents almost as many meaningful choices as real life, or, as his staff has taken to calling it a little derisively, RL. This morning, the graphics look a little jagged compared to Mastery 2, already in the works. But graphics have never meant much to Nile. The visible is only a placeholder for real desire. All he and 500,000 other Mastery players need is easy and endless shape-shifting in a kingdom forever growing. Something twists in him. He takes a few minutes to recognize the feeling as hunger. He should eat, but eating is such a process. He rolls to the mini-fridge and grabs an energy drink and something that turns out to be a chicken puff, which he downs without even microwaving. Tonight he'll make a real meal, or tomorrow. He's assembling a stack of cypress planks from his best team of woodcutters into a mammoth ark when the phone rings. His morning appointment with a journalist who wants to interview the infant industry's rising star, the boy still in his 20s who has made a home for so many homeless boys. This reporter sounds not much older than his subject, and petrified. Mr. Mehta? Mr. Mehta is his father, whom Nile has tucked away in a tiny palace outside Cupertino, complete with pool, home theater, and a pond flanked by a rosewood mandir, where Mrs. Mehta does weekly puja and prays to the gods to bring her son happiness and a girl who'll see him for who he is. A reflection in the plate glass looks up to challenge him. A brown, scrawny, praying mantis with bulbous joints and enormous, tight-skinned skull for a head. Call me Nile.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Wow. Nile. I'm Chris. Thanks for talking. So, first, I want to ask, did you know that Mastery was going to be such a hit?
Nile did know. Long before the game was released into the wild, he knew from the moment he had the idea, under the giant, spreading, pulsing tree at night up on Skyline.
Kind of. Yes. The beta release stopped my workforce dead. My project manager had to enforce a ban.
Holy crap! Do you have sales figures?
It's selling very well, in 14 countries.
Why do you think that is?
The game's success is simple enough. It's a reasonable facsimile of the place Neely envisioned at 7, when his father first lugged an enormous cardboard box up the apartment stairs. "Now, Neelyji, what might this little creature do?" What the boy wanted the black box to do was innocent enough. Return him to the days of myth and origin, when all the places a person could reach were green and pliant, and life might still be anything at all. "I don't know. It has simple rules. The world responds to you. Things happen faster than in life. You can watch your empire grow."
I confess to you, I'm totally in love. Last night, when I finally stopped playing, it was like 4 a.m. I just needed to see what would happen with one more move. And when I stood up from the screen, my whole bedroom was bobbing and jittering.
"I know what you mean." And Neelay does, except for the part about standing up.
"Do you think it's changing the brains of the people who play it?"
"Yes, Chris. But so does everything, I think."
"Did you see the article in last week's Times about game addiction? People spending 50 hours a week on video games?"
"Mastery isn't a video game. It's a thought game."
"Okay, but you must admit a lot of productive time is going to waste."
"The game is definitely chronophagic." He hears a little question mark pop up in a thought bubble on the other end of the line. "Time eating."
"Does it bother you to be such a destroyer of productivity?"
Neelay gazes out on a patch of mountain shaved bare half a century ago.
"I don't think it might not be so bad to destroy a little productivity."
"Huh. Okay. The game's killing my little life, anyway. I keep coming across things that aren't in the 128-page game book."
"Yes, that's part of what keeps people playing." "While I'm in the game, I feel I have a goal, always something more to do."
"Yes, oh yes," Neelay wants to tell him. "Safe and comprehensible, with no swamps of ambiguity to suck you down, no human-on-human darkness, and your own will receives its rightful land. Call it meaning." "I think a lot of people feel more at home in there than they do out here."
"Maybe. A lot of guys my age, anyway."
"Yes. But we're planning all kinds of new roles for the next release. New ways of playing the game. Avenues of possibility for all kinds of people. We want it to be a beautiful place for everyone."
"Wow. Okay. That's wild. So what will the company do next?"
The company is slipping out of Neelay's control. Teams and managers populate an organizational tree he can't keep track of. The best developers in the valley knock on the door every day, wanting to play. Software engineers on Route 128 around Boston. Recent grads from Georgia Tech and Carnegie Mellon. Brains shaped from infancy by the games Neelay used to give away beg him for the chance to help engineer the wholesale exodus now well underway.
"I wish I could tell you."
Chris whimpers.
"How about if I beg?"
His voice has all the confidence of a healthy, ambulatory male. Probably white and good-looking. The charm and optimism of a guy who does not yet know what people will do to other people, to other living things, once terrors and hurts and needs set in.
"Just a hint?"
"Well, it's simple, really. More of everything. More surprises, more possibilities, more places filled with more kinds of creatures. Imagine mastery after it doubles in richness and complexity 40 times. We don't even know what such a place might look like."
"All from a seed this big."
"Oh, that's so amazing, so beautiful.
Something stabs at Neelay. He wants to say, "Ask me again. There's more."
"Can I ask about you?"
Neelay's pulse spikes, like he's trying to lift himself on his set of exercise rings.
"Please, no. Please don't."
"Of course.
I read quite a few stories about you. Your own employees call you a hermit."
"I'm not a hermit. It's just my legs don't work."
"I read about that. How do you run the company?"
"Phone, email, online messaging."
"Why are there no pictures of you?"
"It isn't pretty." The answer flusters Chris. Neelay wants to say, "It's all right. It's only R.L.
"Do you feel that growing up as the child of immigrants..."
"Oh, I don't think so.
Probably no."
"No what?"
"I don't think it had much of an influence on me."
"But how about being Indian American? Don't you feel that..." "Here's what I think. I've been Gandhi and Hitler and Chief Joseph. I've wielded +6 great swords while wearing little chainmail thong bikinis that frankly didn't give me all that much protection." Chris laughs. It's a beautiful, confident laugh. Neelay doesn't care what the man looks like. He doesn't care if he's 400 pounds and covered in cold sores. Desire rushes him.
"Would you like to go out together sometime?"
"But going out would have to be going in." "Nothing needs to happen. Nothing could happen, in fact. That's all gone. We could just sit together somewhere, talk about all things, no fear, no hurt, no consequences. Just sit and talk about where people are going."
Impossible. One look at Neelay's grotesque limbs, and even this confident, laughing journalist would be disgusted. Yet this man, Chris, he loves Neelay's game. He plays it all night and into morning. The code Neelay wrote is changing this other man's brain.
"It's just this. I've been lots of things. I've lived all over, in Stone Age Africa and on the outer rim of other galaxies. I think that soon enough, not right away, but soon, if software keeps getting better and giving us more room, I think that we'll be able to make ourselves into anything we want."
"That sounds a little out there."
"Yes, maybe it is."
"Games aren't. People will still want money. They'll still want prestige and social status. Politics, that's forever."
"Yes. Forever? Maybe." Neelay stares into his screen, a world coming on hard, where social status will accrue entirely by votes in a space that is at once instant, global, anonymous, virtual, and merciless.
"People still have bodies. They want real power. Friends and lovers, rewards, accomplishments."
"Sure. But soon we'll carry all of that around in our pockets. We'll live and trade and make deals and have love affairs, all in symbol space. The world will be a game, with on-screen scores. And all this..." He waves, as people do on phones, even knowing Chris can't see him. "All the things you say people really want? Real life? Soon, we won't even remember how it used to go."